Hello, this is Beth Ludwig from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from the April edition of the Ladies' Home Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This month's issue highlights three volunteers. The first volunteer is teaching literacy. Her name is Gail Elevin. She's age 40, and she works in Fort Worth, Texas. What I do? For 3 hours every week, I tutor adults who read on a second to sixth grade level. We use books, magazines, and websites that engages them and helps build their reading skills. Why I do it? A friend once told me that she thinks that the educational charities are most effective because they help break the cycle of poverty. So when I decided this year that I was ready to do something, I went online and found volunteermatch.org. I keyed info like my hometown, women, and education, and this program popped up. The big picture. I think a lot of people see children as their legacy, their way of giving back to the world. My husband and I don't have kids, so I wanted to do something to make a meaningful contribution. I decided volunteer work would be a great way to create a legacy of my own. Success story? One of the women I tutored is now taking college courses and working toward getting a degree. But really, all my students inspire me with so many reasons to skip tutoring sessions, jobs, kids, chores, and other responsibilities. They overcome all the obstacles and find a way to get there. The real benefit? The people I work with get a lot out of the program, but so do I. It's rewarding to know you are helping people improve their lives. The second volunteer highlighted is Dr. Jill Biden, the vice president's wife, talks to the Ladies' Home Journal about her priority. Here's the question they posed to her. What draws women to volunteer work? Her answer, everyone gets inspired by something different. A lot of volunteers are motivated by specific needs that they see in their community and a desire to fill them. I know that's the case with me. I first started helping educate women about breast cancer after four of my friends had the disease, one of whom died. Another reason is that adults want to set a positive example for our youth. I know for me, it's important to inspire my children and grandchildren to get involved and give back to their communities. Second question posed to her, are there any personal rewards of service? There are so many. I've developed some truly wonderful friendships through my volunteer activities. I also think you learn a lot about yourself, your community, and the larger world when you step out of your own situation and see firsthand what your neighbors and fellow Americans are facing. Being active in the larger community makes you more connected, more empathetic, and grateful. I always emerge from service activities feeling inspired, optimistic, and motivated. What causes are most important to you? Michelle Obama and I have been focused on helping military families. For several years, I've been active in a group called Delaware Boots on the Ground, which works with service members and their families. Our son, Beau, is in the Army National Guard, and I know firsthand how important it is for families to feel supported. How do you encourage volunteerism? I always say that you should start from what you love and know. If you like to read, consider tutoring or doing a stories hour at a children's hospital. If you're a gardener, use your talents at the local community center or nursing home. Whether you're an accountant or a handyman or a lawyer, you could offer an hour a week of your skills to help a military family whose child or spouse is deployed. These simple acts of kindness can make such a huge difference. And when volunteers reach out to others, they will find so much more meaning in their lives. Our third volunteer that's highlighted is coaching for the Special Olympics. Her name is Heather Lodinini, age 26, from Cromwell, Connecticut. What I do? I've worked with athletes ranging in age from 6 to 60. So far, I've coached the track and field, bowling, and basketball teams, usually for about an hour or so a week. Why I do it? Last year, I turned 25, and I had just moved to a new city and was working at a new job. All the changes made me look at my life, and I decided I needed to do something to feel more fulfilled. I ran a half marathon. I remodeled my kitchen, but I still didn't feel satisfied, so I decided to start volunteering. My inspiration? My Aunt Sharon, who lived across the street when I was a kid, had Down syndrome. I'd bring my friends over to visit her, and every time she would pull out her special Olympic medals. I remember thinking, what's the big deal? I have trophies in my room, too. It wasn't until I was older that I realized how much harder she had to work for those awards. Personal payoff? If I've had a crummy day at work, I'm tempted to just go home and watch television. But I'm committed to coaching, so sometimes I have to force myself to go. And I'm always glad I did. I'm brought to tears when I see the look of joy in my athletes' faces. They're so thrilled to succeed at something as simple as rolling a bowling ball and knocking down a few pins. It's always the highlight of my week. My favorite memory? My first stint was working registration for a penguin plunge, where people jumped into a 30-degree lake to raise money for Special Olympics. I was surrounded by hundreds of volunteers who were totally committed to helping people with special needs. There was so much positive energy that I felt truly inspired. No excuses. I've seen the challenges that people with disabilities face. So don't tell me that giving up a Saturday morning is hard. Life shouldn't be about us all the time. Broken promises. Every year, people like Asatu Jalu escape torture and persecution, then find their way to the United States seeking refuge and freedom. What happens next will shock you. This article is by Jan Goodwin. Asatu Jalu had never been on a plane in her life. When in October 2006, she made the two-day trip to Philadelphia from her grandmother's village in Sierra Leone. As the airplane flew over New York City, the 18-year-old stared out the window, trying to see whether she could catch a glimpse of the Statue of Liberty, that world-famous symbol of freedom for the oppressed. After living in a war-torn country, being raped by soldiers, and mutilated by her tribe's people, Asatu hoped she was safe at last. Excited to be in America and exhausted from the trip, the nervous teenager handed her passport to an immigration official. "This isn't a photograph of you," he told her. "I know," Asatu replied quietly. "I would like to apply for political asylum." Asatu was only 4 years old when her country was plunged into civil war. While growing up, she suffered through food shortages, blackouts, and bombings, and witnessed many atrocities. In 1999, when she was 12, rebels overran Freetown, the capital where she and her mother lived, and they were forced to flee. In the ensuing panic, they were separated. Asatu was captured with many of her neighbors. "They lined us up, rebel soldiers walking down the line, cutting off people's hands with machetes. I was terrified," she recalls. "When two soldiers got to me, one held down my hand and started cutting. The other stopped him, saying I was too beautiful. Instead, he raped me. His friends might have taken a turn, too, but a fighter jet flew over. Expecting to be bombed, the rebels took off." A week later, Asatu's mom found the girl hiding, severely traumatized, in one of the few houses still remaining in their burned-out community. The war raged for 3 more years before the conflict finally ended in 2002. 11 years of fighting had left an estimated 50,000 people dead, half the population homeless, and tens of thousands mutilated. When the war ended, Asatu and her mother began to rebuild their lives. but in 2004, Asatu's mother died of malaria. The girl, then 16, was sent to live with her grandmother, Maramama, in rural Sierra Leone. Life was suddenly very different. Her mother had been progressive, but her grandmother was extremely traditional. In fact, Marama was her community's Sowi, a revered tribal leader. One of Maramama's duties was to initiate girls into the Bondo Society, a rite of passage signaled by the practice human rights groups call female genital mutilation, or FGM. In this agonizing ritual, the girl's labia and the clitoris are partially or completely removed, usually with a razor blade, a knife, or a shard of glass, and the entrance to her vagina is sewn up tight, leaving a matchstick-sized hole for menstruation. It is generally performed on girls between the ages of 7 and 10 to prevent promiscuity and prepare them for marriage. Because her mother opposed the practice, Asatu had escaped FGM. I truly believed my grandmother would observe my mother's wishes, she later said in a court affidavit. But at 5 o'clock one morning, about a year after she arrived, Asatu was dragged by a group of women to a small hut. One sat on her chest while others restrained her arms and legs. They stuffed a cloth in her mouth, and without anesthesia, her grandmother began to cut. Weeks later, when she had recovered, Asatu overheard women saying her FGM would have to be redone because her grandmother had not removed enough flesh. But Maramama's health declined, and the village leaders decided it was time for her to retire. Tradition dictated that the role of the Sowi would pass to a female relative. The leaders decided it would be Asatu. There was no way I could perform FGM on anyone, Asatu said, so she ran away, sleeping in the jungle for a week. After tribe members tracked her down and brought her back to the village, she was beaten. I had shamed my grandmother deeply, she told me, Asatu said. They broke my toes, so I couldn't run again. A short time after her capture, Asatu was told to perform FGM on an 8-year-old girl. If she didn't, the village leaders warned her she'd be forced to drink poison. Asatu compelled, but realized she could never do it again. I had to escape or kill myself. Desperate to get out of Sierra Leone, Asatu scraped together enough money to telephone a friend who moved to England, fleeing FGM herself. The friend had a young aunt who held a UK passport and resembled Asatu, if you don't look too closely. The passport and the money for a plane ticket was sent to a trusted intermediary in Sierra Leone, who was then gave it to Asatu. There was only one stipulation. The friend requested that Asatu not go to Britain because she didn't want to get her aunt in trouble. America seemed like the best choice. Everything went well on the trip, up until the moment she handed the passport to the U.S. official. Few people realize what happens to many asylum seekers when they arrive in the United States. Asatu was arrested on the spot and was held at the airport for 10 hours. Then her hands and feet were shackled. In heavy chains, Asatu, who is slightly built and stands just 5'2", struggled to walk to the sheriff's van, which took her to an immigration center. She spent the next day there before being transported to York County Prison in southern Pennsylvania. A sprawling group of buildings topped with razor wire, the York Prison houses violent American felons, including convicted killers. It is also one of the country's largest holding facilities for immigration detainees. When Asatu arrived, it was 9 p.m. and she hadn't eaten all day. She was issued a thin blanket and told it was too late for dinner. As the steel doors clanged shut, she pleaded, "Why am I here? I'm not a criminal." Asatu was right. It is not a crime to enter the United States with false documents when the person requests asylum. It is a civil offense only, which technically should not be punishable by prison time. Additionally, in both U.S. law and international treaties, this country has pledged to offer asylum to those who have been victims of political, religious, and other forms of persecution. Asatu met these requirements. Legal issues aside, the United States has a long history dating back to the Pilgrims of being a safe harbor for people who have been persecuted for religious or other reasons. Our national symbol embodies these ideas. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, says the famous poem posted inside the Statue of Liberty. This sentiment is a huge source of patriotic pride, but our current policies don't reflect that kind of compassion. The Bush administration started a crackdown on immigration in 1990, which President Clinton later expanded, and since September 11th attacks in 2001, treatment has been harsher. Now asylum seekers are routinely arrested by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, which is part of the Department of Homeland Security. According to Detention Watch Network, a human rights organization, Asadu's treatment was typical. Torture survivors and rape victims are locked up alongside hardened criminals in U.S. prisons, where they often remain for months, even years. This happens despite the fact that incarcerating asylum seekers is against international law. As an applicant for political asylum in the United States, Usada entered a catastrophic nightmare. She was in prison even though there were no criminal charges. She was expected to produce documents supporting her claims and identity, but she escaped from a war-torn country where records don't exist. Having escaped a rural village in one of the most poorest nations on the earth, she was told she needed $10,000 to pay for an attorney. The right to free legal representation only applies to criminal cases. According to Amnesty International, 84% of detainees are not able to get legal aid. These detainees must represent themselves in court, whether or not they speak English. Asado was fortunate in that respect, since English is the official language in Sierra Leone. Asado shivered through the winter in her cell, dressed in a yellow prison jumpsuit and flip-flops. She began to have severe abdominal pains, but her requests for medical cares were ignored. She didn't know it then, but the botched FGM had left heavy keloid scarring, which had caused her menstrual flow to back up, a typical side effect of this procedure. Asado had post-traumatic stress disorder from the war, so loud noises and voices in anger, common in prison, reduced her to a sobbing wreck. During one of her panic attacks at York, she was put in solitary confinement, probably the worst treatment for someone who has been traumatized. Again, she was not alone in this treatment. The York prison has been cited by a number of human rights organizations for being abusive to its inmates. Feeling hopeless, Asado spent months curled up on her thin foam mattress. In early 2007, 4 months after her incarceration, Asado was surprised to hear she had two visitors. The names of the detainees are made available to legal organizations and programs, and Asado was one of the lucky ones picked to be defended by a pro bono lawyer, Christine Steben and Morgan Marks, both students at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, had been sent to prepare her affidavit and other documents required for her political asylum court hearings. Franklin and Marshall is one of the only countries in the colleges in the country where undergrads work on political asylum cases, assisting pro bono attorneys. Thanks to the students who have the time to do in-depth research, the lawyers working with the firm's program quietly and consistently win cases for asylum seekers like Asatu. When I was assigned this case, all I could think was, how does a junior in college save a person's life? Says Kristen, who was 20 at the time. If Asatu was sent back, her tribe would most likely kill her. At the very least, they'd redo the mutilation. It was a daunting responsibility and very scary. The two students worked around the clock preparing evidence for Sadu's hearing. It was difficult for the teenager to talk about her history because it made her relive her awful memories. There was barely enough time, but Kristen and Morgan found two expert witnesses, a physician who could testify to what Asado had undergone and another expert who could confirm conditions in Sierra Leone. During this period, Asado and Kristen developed a close bond, and because Kristen kept calling home in tears to tell her family about Asado and the way she was being treated, her mom and dad became involved. Lois Stephen, a medical office assistant, and her husband, Gary, the finance director for a consulting company, sent Asado books, stamps, and money for the commissary. They also opened up a phone account so she could call them. At the prison rate of about $50 for 20 minutes, Asado raked up monthly bills around $600. I would have spent anything to keep her alive, Lois said, and those calls did. She was so isolated. I would tell her Americans are really not this mean. The hearing, once it was finally held, was quite traumatic. Asado, raised in a sex-segregated society in which talking about FGM is taboo, was required to discuss her rape and general mutilation in front of a male judge and attorneys during the nearly three-hour trial. Then she had to wait. It was a nail-biting 6 months before a judge handed down a decision on September 20th, 2007. "We won! We won!" an excited Kristen told Asado and anyone who would listen. Asado had been granted asylum based on her fear of FGM, which since the 90s has been recognized by most federal courts as a form of persecution under U.S. immigration law. The Stephen family had told ICE they would sponsor Asado if she were released and she could live with them in their Glen Rock, New Jersey home. So when she heard the news, a jubilant Lois got ready to pick up Asado from York and drive her there to celebrate. But that homecoming never happened. "I was naive," Lois said. 2 hours after Asado won her case, with no warnings or explanation, the teen was transferred to the maximum security wing of Pike County Correctional Facility on the far side of the state and locked in a cell with a convicted murderer. It turned out that the ICE had appealed the judge's decision. The new claim, which they apparently came up with sometime during the six-month wait, was that since Asado had performed an FGM on another girl, she was a persecutor herself and not entitled to asylum. The Stevens were frantic and immediately called ICE and prison officials, who gave them no answers. Asado's lawyers didn't have the information since she was officially off the case. At last they heard from Asado, who had been allowed one call. Even though she didn't know where she was, all she could say that she was a 3.5-hour drive from York. No one knew what to expect. Asado's case goes to the heart of gender persecution, says Susan Ditchlich, Ph.D., Associate Professor of Government Franklin Marshall, who founded and runs the student program that assisted Asado. ICE's argument exposes a double standard, she believes. Child soldiers, young men and boys who were forced to commit atrocities and kill under threat of their own deaths have been granted asylum here because they were minors at the time. Asado was a minor when her life was threatened if she didn't perform the FGM procedure, a fact that ICE appeal seems to ignore. Asado is a landmark case that should set legal precedent and could go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. ICE spokesman Brandon Alvarez says that the agency cannot discuss ongoing individual cases, but confirmed that the next step in the appeal could take several years. In December 2007, 3 months after Asado was transferred to Pike, Kristen got a call from Asado's roommate, the convicted killer, who wanted to know why Asado was no longer in the cell. Had she been released? The Stevens panicked and started making calls. At 4:30, Lois reached someone who told her that Asado had indeed been released. No explanation, and was at the federal building in New York City, which closes at 6 p.m. that evening. Asado had been there all day, but hadn't been allowed to use the phone. By the time Lois made her way from New Jersey through the rush hour traffic, it was after 6, and Asado was standing on the sidewalk in freezing weather, wearing a jacket. She had an ankle bracelet to monitor her whereabouts, but the device had not been programmed. The instructions were still in the box. She couldn't have been much of a national security threat under those circumstances, says Lois. The Stevens treated Asadu like another daughter. She got to know people in the Sierra Leone community in Philadelphia, where Kristen lives. She even reunited with Amadou Jolo, no relation, from Sierra Leone, a friend of her brother's. Amadou had won the green card lottery in 2002 and is in the process of becoming an American citizen. The two quickly fell in love and married. In December 2008, they welcomed their first child, a little girl they named after Lois. Asadu plans to return to school to become a nurse, but the Jolos and the Stevens live with constant fear that Asadu will be deported. Asadu's monitoring brace was removed in July 2008, but she is still required to check in with immigration authorities in Philadelphia once a week. If she doesn't win on appeal, ICE will rip that new little family apart, says Kristen. My heart breaks for Asadu, and I'm mortified by the way our country is treating her, says Lois. If she loses her appeal, she will make the supreme sacrifice and leave her daughter in America, in this country, because conditions are so bad in her own. As she waits for her appeal to be heard, Asadu is busy making a cozy home. The family lives in the second floor apartment in Philadelphia. Traditional African textiles and photographs of Amadou's relatives line the walls. Asadu's family photographs have been destroyed, but the gap in her heart and on her mantle is being filled with pictures of baby Lois. Every payday, Amadou brings Asadu a bunch of flowers he buys on the way home. The Jolos frequently invite the Stevens to dinner, which Asadu proudly cooks. It's a small apartment, but Asadu and Amadou have big dreams and one haunting question. Will she be allowed to stay? Sitting in limbo. Nearly 400,000 people are currently being held in immigration custody, more than triple the number held just a decade ago. Many are locked up in private for-profit prisons, which get their money from the government's $1.7 billion immigration custody operations budget. Immigrants suffer poor conditions and abuse in detention facilities, according to the Human Rights First. A growing number of detainees have died behind bars, sometimes due to inadequate or non-existent medical treatment, leaving their families with no idea what has happened to them. At least 107 deaths have been reported since 2003, according to Jacqueline Espado, policy coordinator for the Detention Watch Network, a figure that she says even the U.S. government has recently acknowledged was low. Last October, Assistant Secretary for Homeland Security John Morton released plans for a detention overhaul. However, a major reform of ICE and immigration laws could take years. To find out how you can assist individual detainees and help with the reform efforts, go to lhj.com/asylum. That's lhj.com/asylum. In the food section, there's a question and answer. The question is, what's the perfect way to hard-boil eggs? Mine always crack during cooking. Here's the answer. Try this foolproof method. Place eggs in a single layer in a pot and cover with 2 inches of lightly salted cold water. Bring just to a boil, then you immediately remove the pot from the heat and let the eggs sit covered for 12 minutes. Drain, then run them under cold water to stop the cooking process.